Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Doesn't get much better than this in terms of practice conditions. Midway through our retreat here, earlier when we were doing the chanting, I was looking at the Buddha Rupa and kind of surrounded and engulfed with flowers. Particularly the daffodils caught my eye as a sure sign of spring. And with the weather the way it is, it actually feels more like summer. But yeah, ideal for developing the meditation practice, walking meditation, sitting outside, enjoying the beauty of nature, and the simplicity of our surroundings. We're very fortunate. Thinking also about the next bit of time coming up. For those of us who are here at the monastery in our winter retreat, we'll be entering a period of even less engagement. The schedule is going to be reduced even further so that we will not be having any morning or evening group gatherings. No morning or evening meditation except on Saturday and the observance night for the next couple of weeks anyway. And the opportunity to move even deeper into practice and solitude, using the forest, our natural surroundings, to help still the mind, reduce the complexities, and see what bubbles up, see what surfaces in the heart, in the mind. Taking the opportunity to look deeply. We've talked a lot about contemplation of the body in the first half of this retreat. Very foundational, important contemplations of the body that can take us all the way to liberation. Also, as the mind gets a bit quieter, as things start to still, there's the ability and perhaps the natural tendency to start turning towards aspects of the mind, of the heart, the citta, and to see experience that occurs on a more subtle level. What it is that moves the mind, moves the heart, what it is that we can develop to help still that process, to see it more clearly. Might be useful to just review some of the terms a little bit. Citta, often translated as mind or heart. It's, I think, useful to really consider citta not as a noun. And it's hard to do that just with the use of language, because even translating it as mind or heart, all of a sudden we're turning it into some sort of object almost. That's not really what it is. More useful to conceptualize it as a verb. Citta is a process. It's a process of cognizing, process of receptivity to experience. It's the process cognizing all experience, whether the experience comes to us through the body or through other aspects of the mind itself. Through the stimulation that comes through the six sense doors, the five physical senses, and the intellect or the active aspect of mind it gets confusing because the word mano is often translated also as mind. So we've got two different Pali words, mano and citta, both translated as mind, and sometimes that gets a bit confusing. I appreciate Ajahn Jeff's translation of the word mano as intellect, referring more to, well, a broad variety of mental factors, but generally the more productive aspects of mind, the thinking mind especially, the production of mind factors and volitions, mental formations, emotions, things like that, as opposed to citta, which is generally more easily described as the reflective, receptive experiencer. Fundamental aspect of citta being awareness, knowing, the knowing quality, more global kind of aspect of mind. The citta is also the process that has the potential for liberation. So the citta is this process that reflects all of the objects that come through it, through the sense bases. So all the sights and sounds and tastes and tactile sensations and smells and all the ideas from the intellect, all of these, as they manifest and appear in our experience, are known and received through the citta, the mind, the heart. And intrinsically, it's a fairly neutral, it's like a mirror, the process of receptivity. Citta is like a mirror. And when there's no activity, the mirror is clean and clear. When activity comes through the sense bases and the intellect, then if there's clinging or craving, underlying tendencies towards desire or aversion or confusion, then the attention turns towards those objects that are coming through, grabs a hold of them, moves into them, invests itself, essentially, in these objects that come through the sense bases. And then the color of the citta, the color of the mind, takes on that same tone as the object coming through it. So if an unpleasant experience comes through, a harsh word or a memory of somebody who's caused difficulty, the mind or if aversion moves in that direction, wanting to get away from, then the whole citta, the whole experience, this whole process of receptivity, this cognizing process becomes the same. It takes on that same texture of aversion, not wanting, unpleasantness, get away from kind of reaction. Or if it's something desirable, something pleasant, something that promises to offer a bit of satisfaction, pleasant experience, then desire or craving, wanting to get, moves towards that object, picks it up, takes hold of it, invests energy, time, proliferation, and works with it. And the citta turns that color, turns into that experience. The mood of the mind becomes that which craving attaches to. So the mind is always changing based on the objects that are coming through it, as long as there's craving or aversion, confusion associated with it. And it's just this constant process of change, depending on what is moving through at the time. So if we're looking at the goal of decreasing suffering in our lives, dissatisfaction, ending dissatisfaction, looking for a long-term sense of stability, happiness, contentment, then naturally, as the mind settles down, we start to look at the factors that come in through the mind. We start to examine this process of citta in itself, with the body, of course, as the base, the breathing as the base, to help stabilize the mind, stabilize the attention in a quiet way, that we can see this process, this more subtle processes that are happening all the time, and see how the craving or aversion or delusion really steers our experience. And we start to learn how to recognize, let go of some of the more confusing and grosser obstructions in our lives, in our minds, and turn our attention to those that are a bit more wholesome, more skillful, leading to more peace, calm, longer-term stability, sense of well-being that we're all really looking for. It's a gradual process of purification, really, purification of the citta, purification of this process of receptivity and where it takes us. The Buddha has a really nice simile. He uses a simile of refinement of gold in a number of different ways. Lungpa talked about it a number of talks ago, of using that simile of how to cool down the process or heat up the process of the smelting of gold through adding water or through to cool it down, blowing on it to heat it up, and watching on with equanimity. So using the qualities of energy, the quality of concentration, the quality of equanimity, and just watching the process as ways to help modulate the various ups and downs of our practice. That was one of the analogies that the Buddha uses in the gold smelting analogy. Another one that he uses helps to describe this gradual purification, settling, removal of obstructions in the mind itself. He starts out with, of course, there's the miner who goes out and does the gold mining and brings it back to the goldsmith. And what is brought back is this mix of hopefully some gold, but mixed very much with gravel, dirt, grit in it. And the process of refining the gold starts with that first step of washing out the gravel, the grit, and trying to get those grosser impurities out of the mixture. So the goldsmith washes it with water, removes these grosser impurities as the first step in refining the gold. And the Buddha likens that to the mind that is generally mixed up with what he refers to as some of the grosser obstructions, so that if in our lives, in our activities, body, speech, and mind, there's a lot of involvement with things that cause harm to ourselves or to other people, Those are considered these kind of gross obstructions, the gravel, the grit in the mind. So if we essentially are involved with things that break the precepts that were just taken just a little while ago, not necessarily the full 8 precepts that people take for the evening here in the monastery or for people who are living here following them all the time, but more basically the 5 precepts, the first four moral precepts if we're involved in taking life of any creature or taking things from other people, stealing, if we're involved with sexual misconduct, taking advantage of other people, or if we're involved with harsh speech or lying. These are the stones, the gravel, the sometimes the boulders in our mind that we need to start looking at. And the basis of taking precepts addresses this this first level of taking care of the mind, trying to establish a sense of peace. Because when those activities are happening in the body, by the body and by speech, that violate those basic moral precepts, then the mind is quite disturbed. The mind can't settle. There's just really not much hope of looking for a longer-term sense of peace. So we voluntarily say, okay, I'm going to put some restraints around these activities. And take it on and see what happens. It's the basic foundation for happiness, and see what the results are. The second thing that the goldsmith does, what he's now left with, is the mixture free from the gross impurities, but there's still things like fine grit and coarse sand that are still mixed up with the gold. So the goldsmith washes it again to try and get rid of that fine grit and that coarse sand. And the Buddha likens that to now that we've established some parameters around our body and speech, we sit down and maybe try to quiet the mind, but we're still confronted with thoughts of, maybe strong sensuality or thoughts of ill will, anger, aversion, or thoughts of harming. So we've restricted these activities in body and speech, and that's a big thing in and of itself. But sometimes the momentum of habit still exists in the mind towards these more strong obstructions that prevent us from feeling peaceful. So we have to rinse these through again as well, just like the goldsmith does. Perhaps one of the techniques that the Buddha offers for dealing with these thoughts of coarse sensuality or harming or aversion, ill will, is found in his teaching around the removal of distracting thoughts. It's the 5 techniques that often are brought up in talks here, even I think probably this winter retreat it's been referred to in some of the talks, but a very useful way of just reviewing when the mind is stuck in these mind states, how to start working with them in a ordered way, if that's needed. Sometimes that is needed. We need a plan or a technique to kind of hold on to and help us steer through settling the mind from some of these coarser thoughts. So the first way of approaching some of these obstructing thoughts is to see if we can substitute them with something that's more wholesome, more productive, more stilling, more refreshing, more calming. The Buddha offers a simile of where there's a peg in a hole, of driving out that larger peg with a smaller peg, substituting that large one with a small one, substituting some of the coarse thoughts with some more refined thoughts, so that if there's thoughts of anger or ill will, we turn our mind towards patience or kindness as a way of substituting one for the other. Or if there's thoughts of desire, attraction that are interfering with our peace of mind, we try and offer a counter reflection. Maybe if our mind is caught towards, say, acquisitiveness or wanting things or fantasizing about things, we look at the instability of those things that we think will bring us happiness. We look at the impermanence, the changeability, the mutability of all of these kinds of things that we think we need to have or want to have that are obstructing our peace of mind, our obsessions. Or looking at the unattractiveness and things that we normally would think of as attractive as a way of just counterbalancing the strong tendency to want to get wrapped up in things. So that's a first approach that is sometimes useful in helping to still settle the mind from these coarser kinds of infatuations or obstructions. If that doesn't work, then the Buddha suggests really closely looking at the danger involved with following that course of thought. If the course of thought is followed, then it might step back a step and break out into breaking a precept. Might work towards causing harm in by body or speech. So we look at the dangers, we look at the consequence of staying with this train of thought, with this obsession, and really reflect, do I want to go there? Do I want to do this again? Because of what might happen. He offers a very strong image as a simile for this technique of, say, a young man or a young woman who is good-looking and well-adorned, having to hang a carcass around their neck. And the amount of the sense of aversion, not, more like healthy aversion, though, the sense of danger, I guess, the sense of don't want this, don't want to go there, is very strong, very counterproductive to the beautiful state of mind. So it's providing that strong contrast to where the mind might go in terms of its obstruction, and saying, no, let's, you know, look at where this might take me. And sometimes that's strong enough to just allow the mind to drop the obsession, the unskillful thoughts that are taking it away from peace and contentment. If that doesn't work, then the Buddha suggests, well, just see if you can just ignore it. Just drop it. Turn away from it. He uses a simile of just a person who doesn't want to see. They close their eyes. You know, one can sort of think, well, this is just repression, you know, turning away from. You know, that's not dealing with it. And, but it's probably better understood as suppression, which is more of a conscious choice to look away from, rather than repression, which is an unconscious putting down out of aversion and confusion. Stuffing it down is different from consciously knowing that you're turning away from it. just saying, not now, not here, not this. Sometimes the mind will respond to that, particularly if you're able to then turn towards something more peaceful. If that doesn't work, then the Buddha talks about looking a little more carefully at what it is that's causing the obsessive process and watching the proliferative process that comes along with it. And this is, I think, a very skillful technique, actually, and sometimes I find it useful to engage with this even before taking on some of the other ones, called stilling the formation of the thought, stilling the formation of the thought. So it can be done in different ways, but the simile that the Buddha offers is it's as if a man or woman were walking fast and all of a sudden noticed that and thought, well, why am I walking fast? Why don't I walk a little bit slower? And so they consciously slow down, start walking slower. And then, knowing that they're still walking, they say to themselves, well, I'm walking slow, but what if I just stand still? So, just standing still, moving slower, calming the process down. Well, I'm standing still, what if I sit down? And then on, I'm sitting down, what if I lie down? So gradually just slowing the pace, and you can consciously do that with some of these proliferative thoughts. Just constantly looking at it and saying, okay, let's slow down. Let's just see this a little more clearly. And going down below the level of the actual words is very useful. The thoughts, all the verbiage, are actually just really on the surface, running on top of this energetic process. If we can get a handle on feeling this energetic process that's feeding the thinking process, then that in itself starts to slow down the whole momentum. The best place, in my opinion, to see that happening is within the body. This is where the foundation in body awareness is so important, because you can really feel the energy, the drive, the momentum of these obsessive thoughts in the body itself, what's feeding it. So tuning into the body, the breathing, where it is that the agitation can be felt, in the chest or the stomach, the limbs, wherever it is, the tenseness in the face, the heat in the body sometimes, looking at the elements is very useful towards seeing the way that it manifests in proliferative thinking. And consciously allowing the attention to rest with the bodily experience, the energetic experience, and allowing it to settle, to calm down, to come to more peacefulness, tranquility, stillness, as a way of dealing with the recalcitrant thinking process. And lastly, if that doesn't work, there's one last suggestion that the Buddha offers, and it's kind of a dramatic one, and suggested only used as a last resort. It might sound a bit counterintuitive, but if you're about to act on some of these strong thoughts, and they're going to take you to a place you don't want to go, and they're just creating such a ruckus, sometimes you have to really be firm and do what the Buddha says as crushing mind with mind, and basically saying, no, not doing this, not thinking about it, don't want to go there, forget it. The simile he offers is just as if a strong man pins down, crushes, and holds in check a weaker man. So too, one should crush mind with mind. So it's a very strong image. But if it's like you know, child running out into traffic, about to kill, you know, the parent doesn't just sort of say, you know, "Oh, Johnny, watch out," you know, in a meek sort of way. You know, they run out into the road, grab the kid, and pull him back. And sometimes we have to do that with our own minds. Hopefully not too often, but sometimes it's useful, and I found it useful too. It's sort of like just startle the obsession so much that it just stops in a kind but strong way. So this is maybe a few techniques that the Buddha has offered to help maybe rinse out some of the fine grit and coarse sand that's still left in the mixture. And after that, what's left with mixed with the gold is maybe a bit more fine sand and black dirt, or is what the Buddha describes, black dust, fine sand and black dust, that the goldsmith then sees is there mixed with the gold, and yet again rinses it out, starts the rinsing process for the third time. And so the Buddha likens this fine sand and black dust to if we've been able to reduce the amount of these coarser obstructions in the mind, what we might find ourselves involved with is more mundane kinds of thoughts, mundane things that are taking our attention away from the purity of the mind. Things like, construction on the reception hall is going to be starting on March 1st. I wonder what that's going to be like. Probably going to have some big vehicles moving in a few days, and et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. Or you can tell that's what's going on in my mind sometimes. Or maybe more mundane things like, the hydro's broken again. Or the diesel vehicle's broken for the 15th time in the past 2 months. I wonder what Motorsports is going to do with it this time. The Buddha actually describes it in ways of like thoughts of family. Maybe some of us are thinking, I wonder how my mom's doing, how my friends are doing. Or thoughts of the homeland, thoughts of reputation, things that are not quite so coarse, but start to appear interesting to get lost in the process of how the mind moves. So we're left kind of with these productions of the mind. And this is just, you know, to remind ourselves that this is what the mind does. This is not abnormal. This is the way that the intellect, the thinking mind, operates. It just kind of produces stuff that we think might be interesting to look at. So we have to take it, you know, not too seriously. Not who we are, anyway. But we're watching these things, and we want to rinse those away too, because they're, you know, kind of benign as they are, they're not all that particularly settling or peaceful states of mind. And so what we try and do is maybe turn our mind towards more reflections on Dhamma, using some skillful ways of thinking that steer our mind towards actually looking at the process itself, and maybe injecting a few contemplations that lead the mind away from these more worldly obstructions or worldly proliferations into thoughts that lead one towards more peacefulness, contentment, brightening, happiness, skillful states of mind, reflections on Dhamma, actually looking at some of these thoughts from a more quiet state of mind, watching them as they manifest, watching their nature as they persist, watching them as they pass away. So framing, with active reflection, framing these mundane states of mind, these mundane proliferations, framing them in terms of Dhamma, thoughts of Dhamma. And if we can do that, the Buddha likens that as to having removed the fine sand and the black dust. And so that finally what we're left with is just the gold nuggets themselves, these gold nuggets of Dhamma, reflections on Dhamma, thoughts of Dhamma. However, the gold itself is still brittle. It doesn't lend itself to being really shaped into whatever it is we want. So the goldsmith then picks up the gold nuggets that are there and heats them up in a crucible. As in that former analogy, the goldsmith really starts to work with it, heating it up as needed, putting energy into our practice, into the mind, development of the mind, or cooling it down if it's gotten too hot, too active, too restless. Then we sprinkle some water on it to cool it down through various techniques, working with it. And we look at it very carefully. We watch it, we observe it, look on with equanimity as well to monitor the process, to see where it is that we need to adjust. And by doing this consistently and patiently, then the gold eventually, the fine dross, starts to burn off, and the gold becomes more pure. And in its state of purity, after it's been heated up and these fine particles burned off in the crucible at just the right temperature with just the right monitoring and adjustment, becomes malleable, becomes such a state that we can do whatever we want to with the gold, form it into jewelry or coins or whatever it is that the goldsmith wants to make. And the Buddha likens that to even giving up these, letting go of the actual active thoughts, conceptualizations, reflections on Dhamma, focusing very clearly, stilling the mind, and developing to the fullest the ability to still the mind, concentrate the mind, enter very still states like the absorptions, developing insight, all of these, developing the tranquility, developing the insight. This is the process of heating and cooling and smelting the gold and purifying the mind, all the way to liberation. So this is the way, these are just some thoughts of how we can, you know, work with the mind, work with the citta to help settle, purify, and come out with something that's very clean and pure and unobstructed. It's clearing out the obstructions that we normally get so caught up in and that form the color, the texture of the citta, this process, this knowing process. We reduce the clinging and the craving and the aversion that generally runs the experience of our mind. And as we do that, the mind settles back into its more fundamental state of clarity and purity, knowing. peace. But it takes time, and I think most of us kind of go back and forth amongst the different stages. Oftentimes, it's not necessarily a completely linear process, so that we might be dwelling with just a bit of fine dust or a bit of dross with the gold at some lucky points in our practice, and other times we might be confronted with a landslide of boulders back into the mind. And we just have to realize that that's all part of the process too, and to really start to look at the ways that little by little the mind, our own minds, have become purified in different ways over time through the energy that we've put into the practice, and to remind ourselves of the. The benefits that we have realized through effort, even though it's not always in one direction, it's generally moving in the right direction with its ups and downs. And to congratulate ourselves. I was talking with Longpa the other day, and he was really reminding me of the importance of dedicating the merit of our practice to ourselves. Not just to others, as we usually think of dedicating the merit, but really looking at what it is that we've been able to do in the course of the days, weeks, months, years of our practice, and consciously dedicating the merit of that to our own well-being, to our further development of the process, taking delight in it. And realizing, you know, that it is a gradual process. I remember one of the first things when I was Anagarika and Ajahn Suchito was visiting us here at the monastery in the first weeks or months. I can't remember exactly when he came that we opened up, and someone was asking him some questions about their practice and the difficulties they were having, and he was urging them to kind of start reflecting where you're at rather than holding yourself up against some endpoint ideal and measuring yourself right at that point. And basically, he said, you know, the first thing if you're reviewing your practice and wondering the progress you've made is to just ask yourself a very simple question. It's like, have I killed anybody today? If you can say no to that, great, good place to start. So, you know, have you killed anybody today? Nope. All right, good. If you have, well, you know, you've got something to work with. Start where you are. But realize that maybe you haven't done that today. And just think, you know, if everybody could say that, everybody in the world, all 7 billion of us could say that, if all 7 billion of us actually just kept that one teeny little part of the first precept, you know, forgetting not harming insects and animals, but you know, just if everybody stopped killing people, you know, what would this world be like? It's amazing. You know, it's a reflection that other people have brought up before that, but I find that's very incredible, really, when you think about it. You know, I don't even think about the other precepts or animals and things like that. Just, you know, no killing of other people, no homicides, no murders, the safety you'd feel walking out on the street at night, no wars. You know, much less of a need for military spending. The resources that would be available to people. Yeah, I mean, this is the place to start. And then if we work with that and start to relieve some of the grosser obstructions of thoughts, of thinking at the thinking level, all the better. You know, look at the peace of mind that comes from just casting aside thoughts of anger in those moments when you've been able to do that, you know, setting aside an angry impulse through careful reflection, how good the mind feels and congratulating yourselves. Hey, I was able to do that this time. Maybe next time too. Or just, you know, boy, if you're just dwelling in mundane thoughts of construction projects, well, that's, you've really eliminated a lot of the grosser defilements. Much less if you're dwelling in thoughts of Dhamma and reflecting on the themes of, you know, kindness and gratitude and impermanence and all of these very lofty states of mind, not to mention experiencing some of the deep states of stillness and concentration which are possible. So dedicating the merit of all of this, no matter what stage we're at, and saying, I think it's a really good phrase of dedication to remember is Nibbana Pachayo Hotu. May this be a cause for enlightenment. May this be a cause for attaining true peace. May it continue. May the merits of this effort, this practice, result in complete peace, not only for all beings, but that includes me too. So I'll leave it there for this evening, offer that for reflection. Sa-